Welcome to Challenging Colonialism, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of Indigenous California. An important note from the start, the producers are two white male educator academics, and these are not our stories. This podcast will center Native voices, and our intention is to highlight the significant work being done by Indigenous communities to challenge ongoing colonialism, and to broadcast information about the resistance and resilience of Indigenous California in the past, the present, and the future.
Recently, there has been a wave of exciting new books written by Indigenous Californian scholars. In order to support these important scholars and their studies, a series of upcoming episodes of the Challenging Colonialism podcast will feature interviews with some of these scholars speaking about their work. These researchers are challenging the legacies of colonialism and making their stories accessible to our listeners. If you find their work as compelling as we do and would like to learn more, please consider reading their work, which we will link to in our episode notes.
I'm Katie Kali'ia'a. I'm an associate professor of history at UC Santa Cruz. I was born and raised in the Bay Area. I did my entire education through the UC system, so I'm a huge, fan of public education. I'm Urington Paiute and Washoe, and my communities essentially form my scholarship and the work that I do. And I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. Before we get into the book and all those things you talk about in there, maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and tell us a little bit what drew you into kind of doing this study.
I think this study goes back to, I would say, me becoming an accidental historian. I think I've always been interested in family history, genealogy. Native histories have always been very compelling to me. And before I even touched this project, I was working on Washoe language revitalization back at UCLA when I was a master's student. And I actually thought that was what I was going to do next when I got to Cal to work on the PhD. But when I did a little digging, I had known kind of roughly about this outing program, and perhaps not in those words. Outing is, the official words of the U.S. Indian Service, the Office of Indian Affairs, et cetera, BIA as it's now known. But I was kind of fascinated by this idea of domesticity and Native women. And when I actually had a chance to go to the archives, I just pulled up a couple of files and I was like, oh my God, there's a huge story here. Like immediately these individual files of Native women were so compelling and I knew there was such a bigger story here. So it's sort of like I just went down one rabbit hole and it became, a little bit of a good chunk of my life's work, right? And the entire body of what would become my book, Refusing Settler Domesticity. So I came into this, I would say, a little accidentally, but then was captivated by their stories and really wanted to focus on, especially in the sort of the dissertation iteration of this, Native women's resistance and the ways that they were able to push against a system that was trying to control and contain them, and kind of in their liminal standing to continue to push back against matrons, employers, et cetera. So I have sort of a family connection with the outing program. My great grandmother was mentioned in the outing files, not her actual file folder, but they literally mentioned her by name. And funny enough, almost 20 or so years later, her son is also mentioned and he writes to the outing matron, or who would basically become someone to help get people jobs in sort of the U.S. Indian Service later on. So my family's literally in this archive. And my own history, I think, as a Native person in the Bay Area is very much implicated and tied to this outing program. So it's been an exploration, I would say, of family and also, again, a program that deeply affected especially Great Basin and California Indian peoples from this area in the West Coast.
Yeah, you do such a beautiful job, I think, in the introduction and preface and everything of just kind of, drawing this context and positioning yourself within the Bay Area. And you say a lot of things I think are so interesting there. And I think that's one of the questions I had for you, is I was hoping that we could take a minute before getting into the outing program itself. And you write in the preface, you say that the Bay Area has always been a Native place and always will be. And in this, you list some of like the hubs and the resource centers and the history. For so many non-native people, of course, the Bay Area is seen as this kind of liberal white space or this tech hub of the Silicon
Oh,
Valley.
yeah.
I wonder if you could speak to the Bay Area as being this indigenous space a little bit.
Yeah, well, we have to remember that it's very easy to think of cities, especially with sort of like the urban versus reservation kind of divide, which is, let's say, been common for at least 100 years. It's so easy to think of cities as non-native spaces. And you and I both know that to be absolutely false, right? Santa Cruz, like, and that whole area, Gilroy, et cetera, that's Amamutsen territory. Like, that has always been their territory. It will always be their territory. We go to San Diego. There's a ton of tribes in that area, Lisenyo, Kumeyaay, et cetera. So even though we see these spaces, I think, largely as cities that are kind of like non-Indian, supposedly. That's not true. And so I think for me, it was really important to assert that, and to know that these spaces, to really affirm that these spaces are native spaces. They always have been, they always will be. And for me, as someone who was born and raised in the Bay, I grew up going to these like Indian centers and being part of this like larger Native community, whether it's, working at the American Indian Child Resource Center. I used to work for Native TANF. Native TANF only exists if you have Native families. And guess what? We had a ton of them, because there's a lot of Native families in the Bay Area. A lot of those same families go to the Intertribal Friendship House in Oakland or Friendship House in San Francisco or in the South Bay. There's a totally different, community as well. So I think for people who are not from the Bay, for people even who are just not native from the Bay, it's easy to overlook these spaces and think, oh, Indians live on reservations in rural areas hundreds of miles away from here. And it's like, no, as a matter of fact, native people live here and have always lived here. I mean, thinking about Ohlone people in the Bay Area, like these are their homelands that I call home, right? And they've always been here. Some have been, displaced, obviously. Many have been displaced for generations and have literally returned back to their homelands. And how bad would it be to not recognize that this is native land? Like, I think that's really important. And so I hope that that kind of frame allows people to kind of change the way they think about the Bay Area or cities or urban places. Because whether we're talking about San Diego, San Francisco, if we're talking about New York, these are all native places and always have been and always will be.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's so important. You're right to push back on these, right? We have these kind of narratives that we all grow up with. So,
Absolutely.
to kind of set the context as we talk about the outing program, I wonder if you could just share a little bit about you talk a lot about Stewart Indian School in here, in particular, and maybe the Indian boarding schools in general, just to kind of give us a context, and then we can jump into the outing program.
Yeah, I love that you set that up because it's almost like when I talk about this history, it's like the chicken before the egg, because actually outing programs come up at the same time as Indian boarding schools, but they're often not talked about in that way. They're not even deeply understood by people who specialize in Native American studies. So it's a very kind of niche concept, actually. And there's only a couple of books out there that talk about these histories. But yeah, so boarding schools really arise in the late 19th century. And it all starts with Richard Henry Pratt, who's really trying to assimilate Native people, which unfortunately was considered a radical idea at that time. And so he is literally given Indian prisoners of war. And he has this notion like, what if I can, cut their hair and teach them English and put them to work? Like, could I salvage them? And as many people know, or some people know, he is most known for the phrase, kill the Indian, save the man. And so he gets these prisoners of war, and sure enough, kind of makes them look like these assimilated people and says, hey, look, these are not wild Indians. I have transformed them. We could do this on a larger scale, and we could do it even better with children. So he's able to appeal to folks in power, and literally get the resources to create an off-reservation Indian boarding school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And by bringing in these kids at a very young age, the idea is that we can assimilate them, we can transform them. So as he's, creating the school, he's also simultaneously creating outing. And the whole idea of outing was to get, Native kids and Native individuals out of their families, out of their communities, and to assimilate with white people. So the whole goal was to literally take these children and contract them out as student labor. And they're being sent to white homes, white farms, and businesses. Jim Thorpe, people have heard about Jim Thorpe, a celebrated Olympian. He was in Carlisle's outing program. He was forced to work at a home in New York, if I'm not mistaken, and ran away from the outing program. And that's something that I talk about in my book. But it's a really kind of insidious nature of boarding schools. I think labor was very much a central part of these schools, and the outing program was yet just another extension of that. So we can think about, Carlisle or Haskell, et cetera, as just one place of an Indian boarding school. But to me, we must also consider the outing programs as extensions of those schools, where they sent these children into the private homes of random people. Carlisle itself had a program that Pratt devised that he hoped would treat children like family members when they worked and labored as servants in the homes of these individuals and families. He tried to have unannounced site visits, all of those kinds of things. But if we have someone even like Jim Thorpe running away, what does that tell us that these kids are running away from these places? Maybe something more heinous was happening behind the scenes that they didn't know about. And part of what I explore in my book was also thinking about how, as these schools, these Indian boarding schools, continued and grew and expanded across the West and popped up all throughout, California, Nevada, Oregon, etc., is this whole idea of being treated like family in these outing homes. And in these outing positions, really, they threw that out the window. This was a business agreement. They wanted to ensure that there would be cheap labor for the local businesses. And if we look at schools like Sherman, for instance, Kevin Wayland does an excellent job describing that exploitation, that really these kids were being put out there to work on these, orchards and these kind of large agricultural businesses. They're literally part of the reasons why these businesses still exist to this day, because they really were at the forefront of maintaining and creating those empires. This is literally Native kids being put to work, So when we think about boarding schools, I think especially in this, in the advent of Deb Haaland's work and the previous administration's work on the investigation of federal Indian boarding schools, I think it's clear that these schools were labor institutions, and they could be very scary. And children were malnourished in them. They were surrounded by death and disease and all these horrible things. And simultaneously, those reports didn't look into the outing programs, which I think really is important for us to continue looking into the extension of these institutions. I recently was in Hawaii on Oahu, working with a working group. All of us look at federal Indian boarding schools, and it's hard because the reality is that some people walked away from boarding schools, even in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, with a fondness for their school experience. Even as much as, perhaps some people had terrible times, some people look back at it with fondness. So one of the ways that moving forward, I'd like to think is how we can approach boarding schools with both of those truths at the same times. Yes, they were designed to control and contain and transform and assimilate Native kids. And simultaneously, some of these people walked away with their best friends and, made lifetime friendships and met their husband or, someone who'd be very important in their life moving forward. So, kind of talking about, I think that balance is something that I hope to strive to include in my own work moving forward.
Yeah, and I think you do a great job of that too in your book of kind of pointing out
Thank you.
how people create kind of indigenize that space, right? Or how people kind of create their own spaces within this, right? Within this messed up system. I think it comes across. I wonder if you could now speak to a little bit about Stewart Indian School, particularly, and the Bay Area Outing Program. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Stewart Indian School is located in Carson City, Nevada. This is right basically kind of where California and Nevada meet, is kind of the closest geographical element there. And if folks are familiar with Lake Tahoe, with Delauga, that's the center of the Washoe universe. It's not too far from Carson Indian School, as it was first known, and then later Stewart Indian School. These are the same school, different name from different eras. But Stewart Indian School was brought to the area in the late 1890s with the intent of assimilating the local population, which would be Washoe, Paiute, and Shoshone kids. A lot of those kids in that first, period of time, they wouldn't really have had much choice. They literally would have been forced into these schools and taken typically by Indian agents. And, we hear a lot of stories about how some families were able to resist by like hiding their kids. But it's important to note that boarding schools were officially mandatory. Native kids were required to go to these institutions. Many did not have any access to public school, and or in most areas, public schools were segregated, and Native kids would not have the right to go to those institutions. So, as these boarding schools were created, and Stewart in particular, they began to pull from the local population. Most of these schools had some kind of regional aspect. If we go back to Carlisle, though, I mean, that was literally pulling kids from all over the nation. So I would say that a little unlike Carlisle, Stewart was very regional. Again, trying to reach those local Great Basin Indian populations. And Stewart is connected to my family. I'm literally a product of Stewart. My grandparents met there. They both went to Stewart in the 1930s and the 1940s, just before World War II. And it's kind of funny because I think for a lot of Washoe and Paiutes are technically kind of like, I wouldn't say warring tribes, but they have a history. And yet, because of things like Indian boarding schools, it's so common to have a lot of Washoes and Paiutes out there, or like Washoe Shoshone or Paiute Shoshone, or some kind of mix of the Great Basin, largely because of institutions like boarding schools and specifically Stewart. So, my grandfather was definitely in the mindset that Stewart brought a lot for him and gave him a lot of opportunities. My grandmother didn't always express that. And I think now, having looked into the history of outing programs and specifically the curriculum that Native women receive specifically, I could understand that. Women were very much pigeonholed in the entire curriculum of Indian boarding schools to solely do domestic work. No one was teaching them how to be lawyers or doctors or, anything that was considered only for men. So young men in boarding schools could become farmhands, electricians, blacksmiths, masons, actual skills that could give you a career, for instance. That really wasn't imagined for Native women. For most women at that time, it was understood that they wouldn't be entering the labor market. On the other hand, though, Indian boarding schools were trying to teach that. And if we look at Stewart curriculum or curriculum from other schools, we can see that happening in real time. Like the kind of math that Native girls were receiving at Stewart was focused on, math related to cooking or cleaning or buying groceries, things of that nature. So it's really, you can really see what they were trying to accomplish at these schools. But yeah, it's important to note that, even if we talk to when Stewart was created, kids were taken from their families back in the late 1890s. By the time we see a lot of instability throughout the Great Basin and Native communities there, we're talking about land theft, resource theft, etc. People not being able to rely on even like pine nut trees like they used to, because things are literally being taken over, right in front of their very eyes by settlers who are encroaching upon this land. It becomes really difficult to raise your children without the resources that your, family and community had for thousands of years prior to white settlement. So it's very common to look back at the 1920s, 30s, and 40s and realize that a lot of Native families actually used boarding school and willingly dropped off their children there as a means to, take care of their kids because they weren't able to support their entire families. So that would definitely be in line with my grandparents. Their parents willingly sent them there. And my grandfather, swore up and down, he's like, at Stewart, I got 3 square meals a day. I got a pair of shoes. I got a roof over my head. I got all these things. So for him, it was a safe place. It was stability. It was all of these things. And again, he was able to become an electrician later on and found himself in World War II later and built a career on the skills that he actually learned at Stewart. So of course he would look back and I think fondly and be very proud of that time there. And simultaneously, I could see where young women may not think that same thing because they weren't necessarily able to build careers in the same way, unless it was, of course, a career in domestic work. So that's kind of the setting here for the outing program, because the outing program itself officially grew from Stewart Indian Boarding School. And there's records as early as 1911 showing that Native girls, again, Washoe-Paiute and Shoshone girls, were sent to the Bay Area from Stewart to do kind of more minor outing placements. It wasn't an official program that was taking loads of girls every single year. It was more so a smaller effort. And essentially, the outing program really begins with a disgruntled federal employee. This is Mrs. Royce, Bonnie V. Royce. She actually had been working at Stewart, and I think, as other scholars have shown, she was dissatisfied working in, frankly, rural Nevada, and asked essentially the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Cato Sells, like, could I start an outing program in the Bay Area? And he officially gave her, the right to do that and create that program. So we go from this kind of small effort that's slowly being funneled out of Stewart Indian Boarding School to then a separate entity entirely called the Bay Area Outing Program. And Bonnie V. Royce is the first outing matron to manage this program. And it starts out kind of fairly small in like basically like 1918 into the 1920s. And pretty quickly, this program becomes prolific. And because it's no longer officially affiliated with Stewart, it's going to start funneling Indian girls from all over the West Coast. So we're going to see girls from Sherman coming up to the outing program, from Chamawa up in Oregon. There were girls as far east as Haskell that were coming out to the outing program here. So most outing programs functioned where you would send kids out of the boarding school. This operated differently, where kids were literally funneled from different boarding schools to the area to work as live-in housemaids. That's officially what this program did. So, in the earliest years, we're looking at roughly 1920 to 1940 as kind of the spans of this program. We saw a lot of girls from Indian boarding schools, so many from Stewart. And many of these girls were 14 to 19 years old. The majority of the girls who came to this program were literally teenagers. And there were also girls as young as 12. So it was really a pretty difficult program to look at, knowing that we're talking about children here.
You're breaking it down, I think, in a way that's helping us understand this. And I think the fact that we talk so little about these programs, I know
Oh,
Kevin
yeah.
did his book too about mostly, I think, a lot of men's labor right down there,
Yes.
or boys' labor, really. I mean, these are children, right, being
They
sent
are.
to labor in homes. I mean, it's really kind of criminal that we haven't talked about this and people don't talk about this in a bigger level, because it is. One of the things, as somebody, right, who spent a lot of time myself studying early California colonial history, and think about the missions, I'm really struck by, in reading this, the parallels between the mission systems,
Oh, yeah.
exploitation of indigenous labor, I mean, there's so many other parallels to the ways that people resist, I think, or they're just human resistance, fighting back against these
Yes.
things. But settler colonialism, as you point out in the introduction, you kind of frame this a little bit, and you talk about how usually when we talk about settler colonialism, it's typically associated primarily with land theft, right? It's a system of removal. But you make an intervention here when you say state here that quote, indigenous people's relationship to settler colonizers is one of both land and labor. I think it's a really important intervention. I wonder if you could maybe expand upon this a little bit.
Absolutely. I think in writing this book, a lot of the sort of literature broadly was constantly asserting, and this could be through Patrick Wolf or other scholars, that Native people were here and we took their land. It's all about land theft. And it's often looked at as African Americans who were stolen from their communities, brought here to work and labor. And those things are absolutely true. Both of those things are true. However, if we look at even a brief case study of California, we have to also remember the whole other United States is experiencing something like this too. But if we just look at California, we can see that absolutely, yeah, sure, it's land theft, but it's also labor. Native bodies are quite literally being put to work on this land that was stolen. So it's not only am I going to steal your land, but then too, I'm going to force you to work on it for me. And, here in California, we have three large waves of colonization, the Spanish, Mexican, and American periods. Technically, Russia's in that mix too. There's also a labor relationship there. But it just became so important for me to assert that actually, when we talk about Native people, we're talking about both land and labor. Because I think that changes our framework a little bit. I think it really asserts that Native people have been, one, laboring this land themselves for a millennia, right, for thousands of years. But then, two, that they were later forced to labor for colonizing forces. I mean, if we look even briefly at the history of the missions alone, we know that to be true. And if you look at scholars like, William Bower Jr., and scholars who are, great in this labor history, Albert Hurtado, et cetera, it's so clear that it is a relationship of labor. So I think it's important to kind of expand this argument and really look at how Native people and how Native people have been put to work and been forced to labor for colonial forces throughout California. And I think if we look at other adjacent places like Nevada, Oregon, Arizona, et cetera, these same things are true. I appreciate you pointing that out because I was hoping that would be an intervention. I'm glad it came across. And I think it's important for us to frame our conversation about the ways that Native people were enslaved in many senses. Native people were forced into indentured labor. I mean, here in California, one of the first policies that was instated even before California was officially a state, the first thing all these colonial folks got together to do was to say, how are we going to exploit Indian labor? Ah, we're going to create the 1850 Act for the Government and Protection of Indians. It tells you right there, this is what they were concerned with. They were absolutely concerned with exploiting Native people and their labor and how they would secure that for the future of California moving forward. So there's really just, there's no way to kind of think about this differently. We have to understand that land and labor, land theft and labor, they're coming together. And that really, I think, changes the way we think about our relationship with, California, Native people, and understanding that they're getting hit on multiple sides, multiple fronts by this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so you just brought up the 1850 Act for the official name, right? It's the 1850 Act for the Government and Protection of Indians, which is, of course, a very Orwellian named thing, also known as the Indian Indenture Act by anyone who's looked at it, right? And you mentioned that in your book too. And I wonder, maybe first, if you could kind of talk a little bit about what that was, and for a lot of listeners who have no idea that this thing existed, maybe talk a little bit about that. The other thing I think you do so well here in your book is that you tie kind of these historical exploitations to of indigenous labor into kind of understanding what happens more recently, right? And there's a quote there you have where you say, "Outing capitalized on pre-existing practices of Indian labor exploitation." I think that that's such a powerful way to frame it and to understand it, and such an important, right? Obviously, as historians, that historical context is so key. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the act and explain what that was, and then how that kind of sets the stage for later exploitation of labor.
So the 1850 Act for the Government and Protection of Indians, as you stated, Orwellian, it didn't actually protect Native people whatsoever. But we always see this in the history of the United States, these ostensible, we're going to save you, kind of policies. And It's not that at all. But officially, this act was instated in San Jose, back when the capital used to be in San Jose, California. And this was 4 months before US, were essentially California statehood entrance into the Union. And many people in power who had literally built their empires on the backs of Native people got together and created this act. And essentially, what it does is it allows for the indenture of Native children. Up to a certain age. And the idea was that this was only available for white settlers. So even we know that there's like Mexican folks here, black folks here, Chinese, none of those people can take advantage of this policy. It's only for white settlers specifically. And what this means is there's specific age restrictions on this, but let's say you have like a 5-year-old Native child. And a family could literally go to their local justice and say, ah, there's this 5-year-old Indian I'd like to take them. And they could keep that Native child up to a certain age. If I'm not mistaken, it was 15 years old for a girl and 18 years old for a boy. So if they grab that Native child at 5 years old, they could keep, let's say, a young girl until her age of majority, which would be 15. And so, literally, there's actual records of these Native kids who are being taken away from their families and communities. In, because of this policy. What it also does is it creates a vagrancy law as well. This is connected to it. Any Native person who is deemed a vagrant could then be arrested and then sold off to the highest bidder within 24 hours. And that person could keep them for a period of time, earn the monies of their labor for that period of time. And I think there was a limitation of up to 4 months. But at this period of time, we also see that there's not a whole lot of enforcement of these policies, right? So it's to me, it's very likely that someone could be taken against their will for a long period of time. So far, we have Native kids, Native adults, and these vagrancy policies were very arbitrary. Like if you were hanging out at the wrong time, at the wrong place, you could be taken. If you were literally near a place that sold alcohol, you yourself are not drinking or anything. That would, deem you a vagrant. So it's all very arbitrary. It's just a loophole to get Native people and to basically secure Native labor. Another part of this policy was that Native people themselves could not in any way testify against a white person. So that means if, let's say, someone was taken and it's been 4 months and they're an adult and they're like, hey, I'm done here. I served my time. I was arrested under vagrancy and now I've done my commitment to this person. If that person wasn't treating them well, or refusing to feed them, or clothe them, or whatever, enslave them in some kind of manner, they could never say anything against it. A Native person could not say, this white man who took me 4 months ago is not treating me well. You would have to literally rely on testimony from other white individuals in some way, shape, or form to protect you. And so it's really, it's kind of stacking up all these odds against Native people, whether children, adults. So it's a very it's a hideous law, and what it did was really create a lot of kind of kidnapping of Native children from their families, and essentially it's enslavement in any other name, right? It's supposed apprenticeship and all these kinds of things, but it's not really doing that. And another factor is that a lot of the men, as we know, 1850, right? We're talking about 49ers, et cetera. They came here to California to strike gold, and within a year or so would be able to have these Native children that they can put to work in their own homes. It is very clear and has been documented that the huge swath of men that came, because again, it's mostly men who are coming to California at this period of time, they are literally taking in Native kids for both labor and lust, as they would say. So there's a sexual trafficking element of this policy as well. So the 1850 Act, as we can see, it's not protecting Native people, whatever. It's absolutely allowing Native children and adults to essentially be put to work and enslaved for a certain period of time. Again, all these people are reaping the benefits of these Native people. And not only that, but the idea of being a slaver was a legal job at that period of time. You could be a slaver. So you're literally buying and selling off Native kids, Native women, etc. It's creating this culture of enslavement that, frankly, you and I both know already existed, but it's making it legal in California law. And to make things even worse, by 1860, we have an amendment to the 1860 Act. And this meant that before, under the policy, technically you had to have the parents of said child say, yes, we agree, you can take our child into this, apprenticeship, whatever it is. And by that time, they took the whole idea of parental consent out the window and said, oh, orphaned kids can be taken into this policy. And basically, that meant that people were literally killing off native parents just so they could quite literally take their child and indenture them through this policy. And the age of majority also was changed. So initially, it was like 15 and 18 years old. And then I think it became like 26 and 30 years. So 26 years old was the age of majority for Native women, and 30 years was the age of majority for Native men. So we're really seeing how there is very much this culture of like trying to take Native kids and into adulthood and to exploit them of their labor. They're not being paid wages for any of this work, mind you. They're just, the idea is some kind of room, some kind of board. And so, to me, looking at this policy that was so foundational to California as a state as we know it is really seeing how it's so connected to outing. I mean, it looks like outing, right? Yes, these girls are getting wages when they come to the Bay Area, but it's the same kind of structure that we are going to put you into white people's homes and you will labor there for as long as we deem it necessary. So, it's a really ugly policy, and I think really shows that labor aspect that we talked about. I mean, come on. Yes, we're going to take your land, and also we're going to force you and your kids to work on it. I mean, it's pretty heinous, and that's California history. I do wish more people knew about this policy.
Yeah, and of course that builds on what you talked about too, the mission system, which we could look at very
Absolutely.
easily as being, the labor force of Spanish colonial occupation here, right? They did all the labor, they
Absolutely.
made all the food and clothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Santa Cruz census, when I was doing my research, I would run across records. Like one that sticks in my mind is a 10-year-old, I think he was Indian from Northern California, Samuel Offen, I think is the name, and he's listed as being a servant, right? A 10-year-old
Yeah.
servant in these homes, which is just crazy to think about. But of course, it's just one of many, many records that show that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people at the offset are like, what? I've never heard of that. That's not true. But if you literally go to these old county records of these justices of the peace, you can literally see the ages of the children, the rough name, of who they were, because kids were just straight up taken from their families. And a lot of times, and this is a something going on in the background, a lot of times people believe that was a good thing. That like, oh, let's take these native kids away from their parents are no good. They don't know how to raise them. We will give them a better life. And I'm reminded of a girl in San Francisco way after the 1860 Act and everything. She was working in San Francisco. She was taken from, I believe, Shasta County when she was a kid and put to work for a very wealthy family, the Chase family in San Francisco. So it goes to show that even after many of these policies had been repealed, these kids were still working. They were still living the lives as servants in the homes of these well-to-do individuals. And it's important to note, too, that a lot of these kids that were taken in that 1850 Act, these were not well-to-do families. These were poor, broke miners who came out and were trying to strike it rich and then all of a sudden had a child or two, running their home and doing their chores for them. And again, other more possible heinous things that were going on.
Yeah, and the links you made too, I think, are really important to the genocide, right? And of course, thinking
Yeah.
of the multiple books that have come out, right, by Madeley and Brendan Lindsay and others about kind of the the number of militias that are being funded by the government, the number of
Yes.
scalp bounties, and all these other things. When you think about the when they make that amendment to make it orphans, right, it really just paves a way for
Yeah.
horrific stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that policy literally created just like even more murderous conditions for Native families and communities.
Yeah, well, one of the things that you really focus on in the book, and you mentioned this at the beginning of our talk, but that you really focus on Indigenous women's resistance, right? And you write in your book While Indian boarding schools and Indian relocation were meant to assimilate, Native people used these federal projects to their own advantage. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, maybe share a story or two that speaks to this kind of resistance that you're finding in the archives.
Yeah, I think early on, as I got into my archive, again, like there's just files, individual files of Native women and their time working in the Bay Area. And immediately I came across what I thought were just phenomenal instances of women pushing back. And that was, I think, what drew me so much to this project. I was like, oh my God. A lot of times we're not, we Native people in the 20th century, early 20th century are often ignored, and Native women especially. It's like, what are they doing? Like, it's as if we assume that they're not doing anything or pushing back or whatever. And then I open this archive and I'm like, oh wow, look at all these women just saying like, no, I don't want to do that, or you can't force me to do that, or I'm going to run away, or whatever it was. So when I did that first kind of glance into the archive, that's what really drew me in, and that's kind of what I wanted to focus on. So there's so many different instances of resistance, but a lot of them come down to women refusing to work for a certain family if they don't like it, women refusing to work with kids who are not going to, you know, listen to them or follow their orders, etc. Women who are going to refuse to work for people if they're not going to get the pay that they decided upon. This person's kind of like trying to cheat them out of their wages. Women who are not getting paid their wages. Some employers did some sneaky things and were trying to practically get these women to work for almost free, which again is not that dissimilar from this 1850 Act, right? Women who are fed up with the conditions at the home, women who are basically accused of theft in the home, like, oh, you stole an umbrella or a pen or something like that. So for me, it was really important to kind of look at these instances of their resistance, because this system is really trying to control them. And again, like a lot of these girls, let's say they're coming from Stewart, they're support, they're like surrounded by very regimented boarding school life. So the idea of coming to the Bay Area, it feels like a little bit of a freedom. But a lot of these girls signed contracts where they officially, their employer was supposed to monitor them and look over them and report any kind of wrongdoing to the outing matron. If they got a call from like a boy at the house, that was a huge red flag. They were gonna have to pay for that, you know? So just knowing how this system was meant to really contain them, and yet they were gonna do their own thing anyway, I just love that. So some of the earliest instances of resistance I came across were Native women who just ran away. And in the summer of 1922, a lot of girls, a lot of Washoe and Paiute girls specifically, they ran away from their outing placements. They didn't want to be there. They had no desire to be there. And they were able to run away, perhaps had some of their wages squirreled away and got on a train or a bus. And I thought that was really cool. I thought it was a really neat way to say, I'm not going to do this and I'm not interested in it whatsoever. Because the reality is a lot of these girls, they didn't really largely have a choice as to whether or not they were going to go outing. Some definitely did. Some wrote the outing matron ahead of time, well before school ended, and say, hey, I'd like to go to Oakland for, you know, the summer and work in a home. But a lot of the girls that came directly from school, it was kind of like if your name was on a list, you were going to get sent to outing. So I love that, you know, these girls kind of pushed back. I also came across a really wonderful letter of a woman who was working in a Berkeley home, I believe, and the family she worked for was very well to do. And the woman of the house would often put on these kind of elaborate parties. And this young woman would have to work those parties, right? She would have to take care of all these different elements in the house on top of entertaining. I can imagine there was, you know, fine china or silver or something of that nature. And this poor girl who probably came from Stewart and never experienced many of those things, she was only getting paid $25 a month. And for her, that was like blasphemous. So she literally wrote the outing matron and basically said, like, you know, this woman is putting on parties every single week. And if she's putting on parties every week, she can afford to pay her servant more money than $25 a month. So I love that. That was just such a great example of, I'm not going to put up with this. You don't get to have me for $25 if I know you can afford much more, you know? There's also girls who just refused to work at places and just outright said, I'm going to leave now, and would just hop on a train and leave. And I love that.
That's great. Those are great stories, and I think that's so nice and refreshing, I imagine, to run across these
Totally.
stories and to hear hear somebody's voice advocating for themselves in a situation that where they had so little to advocate for them on their behalf.
Yeah, and I think what I really hear, as a historian, as a professor in 2020, in 2025, I often hear this rhetoric, whether it's about old Indian wars or things that happened in the 1930s, 40s. And excuse me, people are often like, "Well, where were you? Were you fighting back? They kind of paint this picture that Native people are not resisting, they're not organizing, they're not, protesting or whatever. And if you actually look closely, all of that's happening. Absolutely. So I think it's important to kind of change the narrative and stop thinking of Native people as like these passive subjects that weren't protesting or weren't resisting.
As you can imagine with the missions, right, that happens a lot where people always say,
Oh.
well, they would have fought back. And it's like, well, the stories of them fighting back are there. We just haven't talked about them. The
Absolutely.
church hasn't
Yeah. Like, have you heard of
promoted
Yuma?
them,
Like,
right?
people literally fought back and tried to take care of these systems, pretty quickly. And I don't know. I hate that narrative, but it's so common in the work that we do. So that's another reason why I think these stories are so important to bring forth, because it's there in writing.
I think of that too with not necessarily in California as much, right? The treaty situation here is different, but when
Right.
people say that in on a national level, and I think that so many people in the public don't realize, well, those treaties are there because they did fight back and they were successful. They were really successful and they were able to negotiate these treaties from a place of victory. And I think then it was later that the US broke those treaties. But I think people
Yes.
overlook the whole context that got them there.
Completely. And let's be honest, we're both historians. This is the history that people don't learn in school. So it's easy to fit into that narrative, right? That people didn't do anything, and yet it's right here in the work that we do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, in your later chapters in the book, you talk a little bit about the resistance. You kind of shift your analysis of the resistance and looking at how families, right, the parents of these young girls also found ways to resist and fight back. I wonder if you could maybe share a little bit about that side of things.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that I was so interested in was like letters from parents, because my archive, it's mostly outing matrons talking about Native girls and also sending these letters to other Indian agents and other officials of the Office of Indian Affairs and just talking about Native girls. So whenever I had letters from girls and letters from their families, that to me was like a gold mine, because I wanted to see, well, like, how were parents responding to this? Some parents very willingly thought of, like, the Bay Area outing program as a resource. Let me send my daughters to the Bay Area. They can work and they can help support us as a family. And that definitely occurred. That really did happen. But other parents wrote with concern for their kids, saying, like, hey, I haven't heard from my daughter in a while, and I just want to know how she's doing. And those moments I think are very important, because it's easy to think that parents are just sending their kids off, but in reality, of course, they cared for them and wanted to know how they were doing. And there was one instance of a girl who made a love connection in the Bay Area, and she wanted to marry this young man. And the outing matron was, I'm trying to tell you that, like, these outing matrons were so concerned with Native girls' lives. It wasn't just like forcing them into this kind of labor, but also monitoring, like, who they hung out with, what relations they were in, where did they go. I mean, literally, like, really intense surveillance. And so the outing matron didn't think this was a good match and literally tried to prevent this couple from coming together. And I love that this woman's father wrote to the outing matron and basically burned her and was like, look, if my daughter wants to be with this man, like, that's not your opinion, that's not your thought. Like, Indian people should be able to date whoever they want, just like white people should be able to date whoever they want. And I just love that this father came in and wanted to intervene for his daughter. And that happened a couple of times in the archive. And I think that's really important to show that, again, their agency and just the ways that families, individuals fought back against this structure that was, again, really trying to control Native people. So I love those stories. And I love the stories of Native women who were like refusing to fall into the outing program and did whatever they can to literally sever ties. Because outing matrons also tried to like take Native kids away from their mothers solely for the purpose of allowing the mothers to continue this outing work, this domestic work as live-in housemaids. And one woman literally just refused and she said, "You're not taking my child, and I'm done with you." And we never saw anything else. I mean, maybe there's something else that happened, but the federal file literally ends there. So I love that women, families, individuals, they were able to put their foot down and push against the system.
Wow, yeah, those stories are so important. And that last one is, I find really interesting too, because it's the absence of her in the future records that speaks volumes, right? I mean, we don't know what happened to
Absolutely.
her, but we know that she wasn't caught up back in that system and that she did get out of it.
Which was really hard to do because as far as these matrons were concerned, they were responsible for any and all Native people in and around the Bay Area. They literally, even people who were not even there for outing, they were like, "Oh, there's a Cherokee woman here," and they wanted to intervene. So it was a really concerted effort to try and control all those issues.
Yeah, so great that you're able to bring these stories out to light. Well,
Thank you.
my last question for you is really just finally just kind of an overview question, but I wonder, what are your hopes and goals for your fantastic book?
I think my goals for this book is to kind of continue this conversation about Indian boarding schools and to know that there's this other element of it that's often ignored. The federal report that was done recently under the Biden administration, it talks about Indian boarding schools, goes so far as to even to include institutions in Hawaii as boarding schools, Indian boarding schools. But they mention outing programs and also state that they were not going to study outing programs. Outing programs are completely not represented whatsoever in that study. And to me, that's an incomplete picture. I think we need to look at these outing programs because essentially every boarding school here and even some day schools in the United States had and operated an outing program. So if we're not looking at those outing programs, then we're not really seeing the whole picture of the impact of federal Indian boarding schools. So I hope people walk away understanding that this was a more complicated system, that it was a very kind of even insidious system. Because here in the Bay Area, like the outing program had ties to like local police departments and local police enforcement, to the Salvation Army, to the Children's Family Home Society, which was adopting out Native kids and other children of that period of time. They worked with kind of these early iterations of like social service agencies, et cetera. It was a very complex web, and all of these individuals and people were trying to control Native women through it. So, just knowing that the system is a lot bigger, I think, than we think it is, and also knowing that labor was such an integral part of Indian boarding schools, whether it's that on-school labor that children were doing, which I don't find too dissimilar actually from missions, right? From the ways that like the Native people themselves are keeping on the lights, they're building the buildings, they're building the clothes, they're making the clothes that they wear and all of that. So, knowing that boarding schools were definitely connected to labor exploitation and that outing programs are, there's just so much more that we don't know about this.
Katie Kali'ia's book, Refusing Settler Domesticity, Native Women's Labor and Resistance in the Bay Area Outing Program, is available from the University of Washington Press. For additional information about the Bay Area Outing Programs, Challenging Colonialism has another episode on boarding schools in our first season. Challenging Colonialism is produced by myself, Daniel Stoneblum, and Martin Rizzo-Martinez. All interviews by Martin, all audio engineering and editing by Daniel. All music by G. Gonzalez, and logo art and animation is by Professor John J. Leaños. Follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast, rate and review on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening.